Hi, this is Nan Evans, one of the hosts of Nature Now. Welcome to this first week of February and our 500th Nature Now program.
Yay!
Whoa, how did that happen? Anyway, we are celebrating. We're celebrating on Zoom. With me today are our two other regular hosts, Deborah Kelso and Mary Robson. And we have a special guest, Kate Dwyer.
Yay!
Founder of Nature Now, and we'll be talking with Kate in a little bit. The basic format for this show, we're going to have some conversations, we're going to talk with Kate, and then we'll have a collection of sound clips from our favorite past shows for your enjoyment. So here we go. And Kate, I'm so glad you could join us today. And I want to kind of take you back to those early days when KPTZ was just being formed. And you had this idea for Nature Now. So how did you get that inspiration?
That was pretty easy. Probably most of our listeners know about Bird Note, that wonderful little show that's on NPR. That was the idea. However, I wanted it to be broader, not just about birds. And I was aware that there were many naturalists here, both professional and amateur, and living in an environment with so many habitats. I just thought a show about nature that was locally based would be interesting. And I had no natural history background other than I'm a nature lover and I hike and so on. But I knew other naturalists because I'd take classes and so on. So I went to a meeting. They had a meeting before KPTZ was on the air for story ideas. And I went to that meeting. Phil Andrush was there, I remember, Barney Burke. And everybody's pitching their show ideas. At that point, I was talking about a 10-minute show. Turned out, of course, to be a half-hour show. And pitched what I just said. And they said, oh, sounds great. Go for it. And
it wasn't a hard sell then.
Oh, no. They thought it was a wonderful idea. But I think they would take anybody at that point. Like I said, we weren't even on the air yet. So I recruited right away Ken Wilson, who's an amazing natural historian and teacher. And Deborah Kelso, who is still with the show, who's a wildlife biologist, and I knew both of them personally. So that's how we got started. And initially, we were doing scripts. Each producer, we produce one a week, would write a script about something. And then we saw that that was pretty boring. So we switched to the interview format and started lining up people to interview. And there are many, many, many around here. And the program just progressed from there. And I was the chief producer for 4 years. And then I moved on to other things and recruited the wonderful Nan Evans to take over as lead.
Yay!
I looked back in the show and was surprised how long I've been doing it. It's amazing. But Kate, you just laid such wonderful groundwork. What's your reflection on how close to your vision is Nature Now now?
It wasn't anything I ever thought of. It just grew, you know, like Deborah threw in the idea of mystery sounds and the program got longer. And then we had these cool, you know, the music was added by the sound engineers and it just grew way beyond my little idea. And one of the things that was fun about it and one of my motives for doing it was learning so much about natural history. Like I say, I'm no scientist. But interviewing these people and researching for them, it was fantastic. And I know our listeners are interested in nature, and I think it's a unique show in the United States. Never heard of one like it.
I'm going to pass the baton to Mary Robson here.
Yes, which is the sounds that open the show. I anticipate the show just from hearing the sounds. I am trained like your average puppy just to listen to it and say, whoa. And I'm wondering, Kate, what composes those sounds? I found a coyote and I found a raven, but I don't think I have found everything that's in that little riff that opens the show.
Well, Ken Wilson put that together, but I thought it was just coyote and raven.
I think it is just coyote and raven, but they're doing a variety of different calls.
Right. You know, and it's one of those raven quick tap things that ravens are hiding behind chameleon type behavior, and this one is. But it is so much fun. Such a good idea that there's something so iconic that says, you are at Nature Now. I love it.
Great. Yeah. And Deborah. Kate already mentioned that the mystery sounds were your idea.
Well, I am a huge lover of bird note, and you know, they always tune us in to a special sound. So I was like, well, of course we have to have sound. Human beings tend to be more visual than audio. And I wanted people to tune into the sounds of nature. So we started doing mystery sounds. Our first clip is going to be one of my favorite mystery sounds ever. And it's described for us by one of my favorite guests ever, Dr. Jeff Hammerson. We've been very lucky to have Jeff visit us several times on our program over the years. He's one of our local fonts of knowledge and an excellent biologist and naturalist. And he and I chat about one of his favorite sounds in this clip.
Most of you will have an easier time identifying the following call. And Jeff will tell you a little bit about it.
Yeah, this was a trick
question. It was a trick, but isn't it so beautiful? It's just an amazing fluty call.
Yes, and so what you've been hearing, the mystery sound, some of you may have recognized it in its normal speed pattern as very, very much sounding like a Pacific wren, which is a tiny little songbird that lives year-round in the forest.
That we all love,
here.
That used to be called the winter wren here, but yeah. They've split them now into two separate species.
Yeah, right? So the ones in the west now they're called Pacific wrens, and ones in the east are winter wrens still. Pacific wren sounds like a seabird to me, so I don't like that name, but
I know,
we're kind of stuck with it.
I prefer winter wren.
A fellow who is a songbird specialist, a bird song specialist, I should say, Donald Kruidsma, these are his recordings. And he recorded these from an eastern population, but it pretty much sounds just like our local Pacific wrens that live here in Port Townsend. Our auditory system in our brain can't process the rapidity of those sounds in a meaningful way, really, other than just as, wow, that is just incredibly fast and complicated and quite a mouthful. When you watch these birds sing, it's quite impressive. But slowed down, you see there are so many. You don't see, you hear. You can actually see it if you do a what's called a sonograph. You can plot it out on paper. Anyway, if you listen to those slow down version, you just realize how many little nuances and different sounds there are that make that up. And the birds process that information. In fact, they can copy it just to make
and that,
it a little.
And that was part of his study, right, is to see whether young birds could learn the calls from their new neighbors.
By plotting this out and slowing it all down, you can look note for note. And what he discovered, the researcher Kruidsma and other colleagues, was that a young bird settling down in a neighborhood for its first breeding season listens to the males that are there and starts copying them. And they can copy note for note all those sounds that we can't even figure one from another. It just sounds like a buzzy blur.
Wow.
They can mimic the other individuals and come to sound very much like them. And it's a pattern that's evident in other kinds of birds as well. Song sparrows do the same thing.
Well, how cool.
Well, that was a fun mystery sound. You know, it was hard enough picking which mystery sounds to use for this show. And part of the reason, I think, is because the diversity of topics is just so big. It reminds us all of the diversity of the natural world. And just a quick comment about diversity. I sometimes think about diversity as being sort of Mother Nature's financial investment strategy. You don't want all your essential eggs in one basket because you just don't know what's going to happen. We decided that we would show you bits of the natural world from the really tiny, tiny, tiny to the huge. So this first is a program I did in 2018 with Dr. Ginger Armbrust, who's the director of the School of Oceanography at the University of Washington. And in my conversation with Ginger, we explored the weird world of microscopic organisms that populate the world's oceans. Why should we know about them or even care? And our conversation ranged between the wonder of diatoms, which are her favorite organism, and to what constitutes a biological species when you look at this great diversity, and to Ginger's love of the open ocean, her idea of the very best day is a day on the deck of an oceanographic research vessel. So let's hear about her favorite phytoplankton, diatoms, those single cell, silica, glass-like encased beauties of the sea.
The particular group that I study, the diatoms, they are estimated to be responsible for generating about 20% of global oxygen and organic carbon. So that's about as important as all of our tropical rainforests.
Wow.
So these little unseen organisms play an incredibly important role in how our planet functions and what makes it habitable for the rest of us.
And one of the things that I just love about diatoms is the drawings and pictures I've seen of them. They are so beautiful.
That's the whole reason I got into it in the first place, is they're beautiful to look at.
So describe one of your favorite diatoms.
That's a hard one because I have so many favorite ones, of course. But they come in so many different shapes. The average diatom, the length of them is about the width of a human hair. So that's about average.
Okay.
Now, some of the smaller ones, you could fit multiple ones across the width of a human hair. And the largest ones would be a few human hairs, right? So that's the scale that we're talking about. When you look at them, and they've been prepared to look at them under a regular microscope, they have sort of a golden brown color, and they have these remarkable shapes because they live, as you said, they basically live in a glass box. And so these glass boxes can come in all sorts of shapes. They can have long spines that come off of them that are hollow, a hollow spine made out of silica, same silicon that you're familiar with. So they have these incredible shapes. If you look at them with a particular wavelength of light, if you look at them under blue light, you can see the chlorophyll in them. That's the way that they absorb light energy. You can see that in these beautiful red colors. So really, I fell in love with them because of how they looked. And then I figured out more about how important they were. But it was their looks.
Their
that
looks,
first got
yeah.
Me.
I would encourage any listener to Google diatoms and look at pictures or drawings because they're wonderful.
Yes.
Oh, I love that piece, Gingers. It'll make listeners want to go look at diatoms for sure. And it's well worth listening to several times. Well, as an example of the very large instead of the very tiny, please listen to our next mystery sound, described for you by another of our favorite guests, Dr. Fred Sharp.
And we're going to let Fred tell you about it.
Well, you guessed it. You guessed it that sound emanated from a humpback whale. And what's remarkable about this sound is that it comes from its blowhole. It's an in-air sound that we can hear above the water traveling across the surface, sometimes for miles. And it's got that bizarre, breathy, moaning raspberry sound. It's the puckering of the blowholes. We have no idea what the function is.
And you describe it as a purr.
As a purr, yes. Yeah, kind of that beautiful purr. And what's cool about them is that the sound is that we can actually use them as an indicator of how far a whale is away from us. Because as they get further and further away, only the low frequency components, this really amazing deep moan comes to us from sometimes over the curve of the earth. Sometimes we can't see any spouts, but we hear these moanings coming to us through the air. And it's an exciting part of our research this summer is to try to understand the sound a little bit more, the behavioral context, and do some underwater playbacks of these sounds to see how the whales respond.
this next clip has him speaking about his primary work for the last few decades, humpback whale ecology with the Alaska Whale Foundation.
That seems like a lovely way to introduce the topic of humpback whales. We saw a bunch in this area, Fred, this summer. Can you tell us a little bit about why we're seeing so many here?
Well, it's so incredibly exciting to get all of these reports of humpback whales moving into our waters. And of course, they were once very numerous around here. Tragically, at the beginning of the last century, there was an intensive commercial whaling industry in these waters. And there were several whaling stations, one out at Grays Harbor. There was a couple on the outer coast on Vancouver Island, and there was one in the inland waters here in the Straits of Georgia. And that was the era of steam-powered catcher boats and exploding tip harpoons. And within a few years, they completely depleted our local population of humpback whales.
When did that happen, Fred? That's so amazing to think of now, that we would have enough whales for a whale hunt.
Yeah, that was about 1905, just around the turn of the last century when things really got going and there was lots of investors, and we'd already depleted some of the other species of whales, the sperm whales and right whales and bowheads. And so the industry was looking for other whale species and whale products, and they took hundreds and hundreds of whales out of our local waters, and the Grays Harbor Station took over 2,000 whales.
Wow.
And tragically, they exhibit a lot of home range site fidelity during the summer months, and so they come back to the same areas and can really quickly not only deplete a population, but also the cultural knowledge associated with these whales. But that's why it's so exciting to hear that they're coming back. And it's been wonderful. You know, we run our boats up and down the coast over the years, and it seems like every year we just come into small bays and meet more and more people who come running down the dock and say, they're back. We had humpback whales here for the first time in recent memory. And so that's just what happens when you have a species that is very clever and innovative and has a very diverse diet, and you stop killing them, they are coming back.
I'm going to introduce Dr. Fred Zentner, who teaches geology at Central Washington College, has for years. And he says that people learn better from a happy teacher. If you ever want to see somebody happy about geology, you have to meet Nick. He did a television show called Nick on the Rocks and has received awards for his ability to transfer information about geology to the general public. He's quite remarkable. And in this little clip, we're going to talk about plate tectonics. Plates are much bigger than whales. And when they make noise, you don't want to be around, actually. But this is Nick on plate tectonics. And we'll carry on with that.
What are the tools used to find it, to measure it, to, in other words, say you are now this detective with an active crime going on, perhaps.
Right.
What are the geophysical tools that you have to measure these?
There's a couple things. The Juan de Fuca plate, first of all, is the last little piece of the Farallon plate. So there is a connection that
That's
way.
Interesting.
We've just given, so we're on to the naming game again. So, you know, we originally discovered tectonic plates. This is back in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next step was realizing, oh, there's this cute little ocean plate that doesn't have a lot of size but is subducting beneath the Pacific Northwest. Let's call it the Juan de Fuca plate. Fine. And then the detective game figures out that the Farallon plate used to be much bigger. So there's, if you say the word Farallon, you're talking about the geologic past. If you talk about the Juan de Fuca plate, you're actually talking about that remnant of the Farallon plate that's still with us. But to answer your question, we have these amazing receivers, these instruments. I can best describe them as a piece of expensive equipment that's sitting on a tripod, and the tripod is cemented into the top of a mountain. So it's a permanent instrument. And these were installed about 20 years ago. And that instrument can communicate with satellites in space.
Uh-huh.
And this sounds like science fiction to me because I know very little about it, but I'm convinced that it's a real thing because we have ongoing measurements between these three satellites in space and these individual receivers. And we can monitor tiny movements in the crust, and we can actually measure the rate at which tectonic plates are moving. So there's a beautiful station on top of Mount Olympus. There's another one in downtown Renton. There's another one on the top of my building here in Ellensburg, Washington. And they're all getting data every half a second pouring into our laboratory. And so we can physically measure these tectonic movements. And even with the Juan de Fuca plate, I really don't understand the technology there, how you can actually measure ocean plate movement. The same kind of techniques work there. And I'm ill-equipped to talk about how we measure those ocean plate movements, but the data is there.
Our next Mystery Sound clip features wildlife biologist Karen Holtrup from the Quilcene District of the Olympic National Forest, speaking with me about one of her favorite sounds.
So you all thought that this was merely the sound of a bee buzzing, right? Well, you would be wrong. It's much more than that. It's the sound of buzz pollination. Do you want to tell us a bit about that, Karen?
Sure. So when a bee vibrates its flight muscles, this is buzz pollination. It actually vibrates its muscles to dislodge pollen from the flower. Sometimes a flower has adapted, for example, tomato plants, so that the bee can't reach it with its tongue or its leg. So the bee vibrates to release the pollen, and the pollen is expelled out onto the bee. Real interesting, I think.
For those of you in the listening audience, you should go search, and there are several little clips on bees doing that, these great little video clips on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And when I saw and heard it, I realized that I've heard that countless times, but I kind of thought that it was that the bee had gotten trapped in the flower somehow, that it was trying to find its way out. But instead, it's actually doing this for a very specific purpose.
Yes.
And it's only bumblebees and certain species of solitary bees that do it, right? Honeybees don't do this.
No, I don't think honeybees do it. There's just a few species that do, some bumblebees and some other bees, like you said. Yeah.
And online, they were saying it's the pitch also of the vibration, that you can do the same thing with a tuning fork. In middle C, a tuning fork will cause the plant to release pollen also.
Wow, that's interesting.
I should
go try it.
No, I mean, they did online. They had the tuning fork, and you can see the flower releasing. And there's certain, I mean, they're very important members of our food plants that are...
Yeah, like tomatoes, for example. And I think blueberries as well.
Potatoes. Actually. There are several families that it has to be a bumblebee or a solitary bee that performs this buzz pollination before they will release pollen. So it's an amazing world out there if we just pay attention.
Yep, that's right.
Yes.
This was our Mystery Sound to go with the program where Karen was speaking with us about one of their ongoing research projects on the forest, surveying for native bee species.
You know, we're coming to the end of the show. I really want to thank people for listening and encourage you to come back next week, because we had so many great things we wanted to share with you that we've decided to do part two. And of course, I'm going to encourage you to go roam around the KPTZ website looking at various podcasts from Nature Now.
We've got hundreds of podcasts.
And they're really fascinating, really fascinating. I do want to take a moment, give a wonderful round of applause and great credit to all the sound engineers and editors who have worked with us over the years. At the very, very beginning was Chris Shapiro, Charlie Fleischman, Alex Henley, Nora Petrich, who is, of course, our sound engineer right now and who is doing an amazing job putting the pieces of this show together. So thanks to all those people at KPTZ that make this work.
There is something that happens at the end of a show. We will say thanks for listening, and you will go away because you think nothing else is going to happen. But at the end of a show, there is music that is selected to fit the pattern or content of the show. It's often fascinating. You will notice some 500s in the one we're going to play today. Special thanks to Charlie Fleischman, who used to love putting these musical efforts together. So don't leave too soon. You'll miss something.
Well, we all love picking the music. And in that spirit, our closing music today is 500 Miles, a cover of a Hetty West song by Justin Timberlake with Carey Mulligan and Steve Sands. As always, wishing you happy trails.